And up next is the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So I will be bringing our splendid guest in a few moments. One of his great book titles, and there are so many, he's written 60, Zombie Politics and Culture in an Age of Casino Capitalism, a great title. We will be honoring the book, also The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine. So part of our theme is we got to go through Act 4 to earn Act 5, and that's what our guest is so good at, leading and guiding and co-guiding. So that model, given to me by a long time ago by a great playwright, said the problem with modern storytelling is that it doesn't know the five-act structure. And she said basically Act 1 is here we are, Act 2 is away, woo, Act 3 is oops, oh, Act 4 is evil, whoa, and Act 5 is here we go. Let's create the better vision, the wedding, the kiss, the marriage, the how it could be. So she says modern storytelling sometimes skips Act 4 and tacks on a happy ending, and you can't do that because there's no power to it. And sometimes modern storytelling ends in Act 4, you know, oppression plays. So we are navigating the world, the underworld, of course, and one of the things we love, again, as we are dedicated to assuming cultural narrative lead, is the power of language. Just a little bit, I was going through email roulette, going delete, delete, delete. Oh, wait, where's that thing? And an ally, a critical listener, John Faraday, hello out there, sent me a great critique of me, some very critical, but some very wonderful, and I just want to put part of it on the table. He says, there are perfectly intelligent people across this nation and planet who have been cornered into a fight. We understand the sacrifices that must be made. I think that what you provide to some of us on the militant left is a broadly inclusive and vastly amusing umbilical to a fluid spirituality. Your vision and voice, let's say our vision and voice provide an original and layered version of a resolved destination beyond. At inception, an imaginative alternative to criminally complicit conventional theology. I'm not going to say, you know, reach to say that your pacifist optimism is empirically contagious. Clearly and rationally, greater sacrifice remains imperative for attempting environmental salvation. But your show offers an inspiring, inclusive, and oxygenated vision of a place where our species can come back into balance. We're all presented paths, constantly and multiply. You know, let us all be important leaders of a flotilla floating down a very unique tributary. Those of us paddling hard on a parallel fork of militancy can still see across to and appreciate your motives, methods, and ebullience. Although absent your determined optimism, our distant optics still hope that our torrents merge. Our chosen current necessarily bears blood, but it is spilled in pact that a future day shall come when it will be diluted after joining the clear and splashy waters enjoyed by your create-your-own-reality canoeists. Anyway, very witty and great language. So we are more than perfectly, therefore, welcoming amazingly prolific, fierce social critic Henry Giroux. Got to earn Act 5 by going through Act 4. We go outrage poker to a blessing poker. I met Henry decades ago in Providence, Rhode Island, and it is such a delight to see his work through the years, and that we're both still really doing what we were doing. He is McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and Distinguished Visiting Professor at Ryerson University, and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical pedagogy, and it goes on and on. Henry A. Giroux, GIROUX.com is his website, and there's a fantastic interview with Bill Moyers that you can find probably there, but also on my Facebook page, Coyote Network News. Welcome, Henry.
Oh, hi, Caroline. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, it's great. You know, as I was saying backstage, you know, it is so delightful to reconnect because some of our conversations way back in Providence, Rhode Island in the 80s are still really resonant. I remember stepping out of a Bergman movie with you, and you said, "No, bleeping Bergman, it's all personal problems, no social collectivity." That was good.
It's actually gotten worse, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, yes, although, you know, Bernie Sanders, may he be praised, you know, is being very lucid. He says everybody's scared of, you know, social, democratic socialism. He says, I'll tell you what it is. It's Scandinavia. I'll tell you what democratic socialism is. It means health care for everybody and free tuition for all students. That's what it means. And then everybody goes, oh, we like that. You know, so... Yes, we bring that into play. But the violence of organized forgetting, you say, you know, the past systemic, and I do think you're uniquely equipped to do outrage poker going, do you know about this? And do you know about this? And we want to put some Act 4 certainly on the table, and then, you know, what we can do. But, you know, Bill Moyers started off, and I will copy from him. What have we been forgetting?
Well, I think that one of the things that we forget is that capitalism and the market are not actually equal to democracy. I mean, I think that we have lost an ability to understand the social part of who we are as individual and collective agents. I mean, I think there's been such a sustained attack on all things social and all things public and the social contract that we find ourselves in a world in which everybody is engaged in social combat. I mean, it's a world that's marked, I'm sorry, it's a regime of neoliberalism globally that's marked by a set of assumptions that are not only wrong, they're just barbaric. I mean, in terms of what they do to the planet, what they do to social relationships, what they do to public provisions, what they do to the social good. And I think that what we're constantly forgetting, and for a reason that's not of our own making, is that justice is something that's never finished. I mean, that, you know, the real issue is not whether there's some endpoint here that we can reach. I mean, the real issue is, you know, is to recognize that no society is just enough, and that we need to really begin to take seriously the educative nature of politics. I mean, meaning that we need to recognize that politics is a way of changing the way people see things, trying to understand how and make clear how, you know, how power works to make things invisible, and that we need to in some way address what it means to take up these problems in a language that's rigorous and accessible but touches people's lives. I mean, you know, we as I say in this book, you know, there's a massive disimagination machine out there, and what it wants to do is it wants to argue that, you know, that this regime of neoliberalism, I mean, you know, it's profit is the essence of everything, is, you know, governs all of social life, and that's not true, and it shouldn't be true. And I think that what it wants to do is erase all those memories of collective struggles, anarchist schools, socialist schools. You know, when people stood up and said, "We've had enough. This is bullshit. We're not going to take this anymore."
Oh, okay, right. Yes. Careful. There's four words, but anyway, I'll fill out the forms. No, absolutely. And part of also, you know, backstage and then way backstage in Providence, you know, I was reading all of my anarchist, you know, thing. Emma Goldman's fantastic autobiography, Living My Life. But she reminds us, as do you, you know, and you grew up with this in working class Providence, that, you know, in the 30s and even, well, it starts to be suppressed in the war fervor of the 40s. But in the 20s and 30s, this country was alive with, you know, intellectual working class meeting and talking and arguing about how should we be governed and what is the best design, you know, in small theaters like in Providence, Rhode Island and Baltimore and, you know, and small cities everywhere. And that has been narcotized, you know, but we're really calling, as you do, you know, for, you know, let's get engaged, let's get smarter, let's have education, let's feed and encourage the imagination, you know, of all beings and of youth. Yeah.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think that where that insight, which I think is a terrifically important insight, is that you have to remember that, you know, ideas don't work if they're on public spheres to nourish them.
Right.
And it seems to me that we really need to reclaim a history in which it was very, very clear that those public spheres not only existed, but they existed in the name of democracy. They were imaginative. I mean, they spoke to a revival of the radical imagination to reinvent democracy. You know, they launched comprehensive education programs. They talked about developing new political formations. I mean, they talked about the need for social movements that were disruptive, that shifted public consciousness and opened spaces for change. I mean, they actually so expanded the notion of education that it was impossible to simply talk about education as schooling, whereas today education has collapsed into schooling, and schooling has collapsed into training. And outside of that, all public spheres that aren't organized around market values and market determinations and the notions of commodity exchange are simply seen as useless, if not disdained. You know, I mean, as I listen, for instance, to these Republican extremists who really now have taken over the government. I mean, when you get a guy like Santorum, whose mind is completely unburdened by a complicated thought, you know, get up there and say things like, we don't need intellectuals in the party, they're bad for the party. Or says the Pope shouldn't talk about climate change. Or, you know, says women really should be wrapped in saran wrap and, you know, meet their husbands at the door, so to speak, metaphorically speaking. I mean, this is really a serious problem, because we're talking not just about the collapse of public spheres, we're talking about the collapse of civic literacy. And I think when you look back in the 30s and the 40s, the socialist Sunday schools, the anarchist schools, I mean, all of those things took the question of literacy, consciousness, and politics seriously. They were intermingled because they were the foundation for the formative culture that produced the possibilities of a critical and engaged sense of agency.
And just out of curiosity, in the background, is somebody building a new world or a new city in your room? I was just curious. Anyway, there's sounds of construction or somebody cooking.
My house is next to a highway. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's a highway. All right. Well, let's imagine.
Not a highway. It's a main street. I'll walk into another room.
No, that's right. No, it's fine. It's fine. But let's imagine it's a new world being built as you speak. I did want to also bring up, you know, that we have myths, you know, big things, fairy tales. But detective novels often are a popular culture form of critique. I mean, the best, you know, it was Robert Parker's detective novel, Bad Business, that really explained mark-to-market accounting to me. I'm going, oh, I get it. My God. And I've been reading your wonderful book, The Violence of Organized Forgetting, simultaneously with the new Spencer Robert Parker novel written by Ace Atkins. But it's all about the privatization of prisons for youth. It's really good. So we do have these venues also of, you know, kind of creative animation of, you know, feeding the creative suspicion and the irony of all of us going, ah. So, you know, I mean, I want to stay in Act 4, and you bring up everything terrible, but at the same time going, yes, that is true, and there is a stirring, there is an awakening. I mean, you're speaking to the home team right now, but it's useful because the home team spirals it out.
Let me make something clear. I mean, in all of my work, you know, one of the things that I always begin with is, look, you need a language of critique, but you also need a language of hope.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can't have critique without a sense of possibility. And at this point, simply because the questions have raised the issue of what's wrong, I'm focusing on what's wrong. But at the same time, I mean, whether we're talking about the Black Lives Movement or we're talking about people all over the, young people all over the world who all of a sudden find themselves trapped in forms of immiseration that are unbearable, but also find themselves being written out of the logic of democracy. I mean, our resisting and our forming movements and our attempting to create a new language and our attempting to create new political formations. Personally, you know, Bernie, you raised the point about Bernie Sanders. I mean, Bernie Sanders is interesting, but remember, he's part of the Democratic Party. And it seems to me that the Democratic Party, like all other parties, the major parties, are basically parties of billionaires. I mean, these are parties basically supported by the corporate elite. And I think that what we need, what I find in these youth movements, is that not only are they focusing on very specific problems and relating them to larger contexts and developing new strategies in doing that, but they're creating new political formations, and that's really exciting. I mean, that I find exciting. I mean, Bernie Sanders, sure, I love the language, but it's not going to happen in the Democratic Party. That's for sure.
That's true. You know, we want this conversation. We want everybody to engage in this conversation, and part of the kind of guiding sky earth myth story right now is perfect to welcome you, Henry, because it is all about, you know, intellect dedicated to vision of collective well-being, power of imagination, you know, linking super sharp, smart critique and intellect into this realm of imagination and collective well-being. That wants to come back, you know, as you say, you know, or I guess I put it in mythological language, but we've outsourced leadership, also known as Saturn, you know, to sociopathic dingbats who have no sense of kinship. You know, even the skull and bones ritual, right, that people go through, in which we outsource economic and political power to them, it involves a ritual of killing their feeling. They go, the sense of feeling is weak and I kill it. And we go, we'll give you power then. So this is all, we want to throw this all into the composting cauldron.
No, I think there's a real sense of how the system works to embody a sense of disengagement, intellectually, emotionally, psychologically, and aesthetically. And I think that's one of the reasons I talked about zombies. I mean, I think that, you know, what you have here are these creatures, you know, these bloodlusting, fang, pale-faced creatures chomping on strings of human flesh and sinew. I mean, they have a ravenous appetite for destruction and civic catastrophe. And I think that what we're seeing here is we're seeing all of a sudden people waking up, as I looked at some of your work, you know, this emphasis on the imagination to me is crucial, and it's one of the reasons why for me education is such a vital element of what this means. I mean, to talk about being to be educated, I mean, to talk about, you're talking about an education that disturbs and inspires, right?
Right.
It doesn't only shift people to think. I mean, it also energizes them. It allows them to imagine, to think otherwise in order to act otherwise. And I think that where the left has really failed for me, is they don't take education seriously. They don't take this question of the imagination seriously. They're always talking about structures, and they're always talking about what's wrong. And then they take the temperature, and then they move right. They become centrist, because they're so cynical. And I think that what we see in the younger generation is really an abandonment of that logic. I mean, I increasingly, you know, certainly among black youth, I mean, no, and brown youth, no question. And that's a good sign. And I also think, as you say, you know, there are other modes of literacy in which there are glimpses of how the system works, but also glimpses of what it might mean to overcome that system that you never find in the New York Times Book Review, for instance. I mean, these are marginal kind of outlying public spheres that increasingly are growing in a web of interconnections that actually are beginning to constitute an international public sphere. And I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, there's so much. This is a great rollicking romp. May it continue and inspire others to keep romping too. After much of what you say, you know, the disappointment of the left, I want to chime in without being a Pollyanna, just the power of language going, until now. Remember, you know, Brecht has this great essay, Five Obstacles to Telling the Truth. I like to turn it into Five Opportunities for Telling the Truth. But he goes through them and he says the greatest one of the progressive team is they tell the story about we are up against, you know, we are good people up against the state terror and violence, and we are crushed, but we are still good. And he goes, we have to quit telling the story about how the good is weak, as water is wet. We want to tell the story about how the good is strong. And we go, yeah. Another great Brecht thing I want to toss to you, because a lot of your book deals with this. He has one of his characters in Threepenny Opera, I think, say, what is the robbing of a bank compared to the founding of a bank? You know, which, again, proportion is very important. There's a fun phrase. It's a good conversation starter. No fortune without a felony. You know, because it's like you sort of go through your mind going, oh, well, maybe I don't know. You know, maybe an artist. I'm not sure. But I want to toss that to you, two things, no fortune without a felony, but also what you deal a great deal with in The Violence of Organized Forgetting, which is, you know, proportional discrepancy. What is the robbing of a bank compared to the founding of a bank? Wherever you want to jump in on that, no fortune without a felony, does that amuse you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, because it actually says something that's humorous, but unfortunately very true. Because increasingly, where we do see great fortunes, it's impossible to imagine that those fortunes in any way haven't been built on the backs of all kinds of people who now are basically punished for the condition in which they now find themselves. I mean, you know, when you talk about banks that are too big to fail, and you talk about HSBC, who actually engage in terrorist activities, I mean, you know, swapping money for you know, trading money in ways that supported terrorist groups, and they get off with nothing. I mean, just simply a slap in the wrist. And then you see whistleblowers in the United States who are basically exposing illegalities go to jail. You begin to get a sense of what that means. I mean, it seems to me what we're talking about is a relationship between inequality, power, and corruption. I mean, and how inequality produces carcinogenic environments, and how those environments increasingly now exist in what I would call an era of lawlessness, simply lawlessness. I mean, in which the police now are occupying armies, in which the government sort of kills people arbitrarily with drones, you know, in which we arrest people without having them have the opportunity for engaging their civil rights, their liberties, or, you know, it goes on and on. So I think those metaphors are interesting because they point to something new, not something old. They point to a new configurations of power, capital, and it seems to me inequality, in ways that are reconfiguring the very nature of politics itself. And I think that's where they become useful. They become very educative in that sense.
And maybe also we can think of outrage as inclusive, invitational community building. Aren't we all outraged at this? You know, and the idea of, you know, again, crossing borders to find a common story. I mean, I do cross borders and go talk to conservatives and Tea Party people, whatever, and go, is there any modicum of sanity in here? No. Yeah. Okay. You know, Nebraska tried 37 times before to abolish the death penalty, and they just did it, you know, all Republican driven. We go, That's good. We encourage that. More of that, team. There you go over there. But what about, you know, outrage as inclusive? One more parenthesis before I toss it to you. You know, because so much of our team, again, the progressive left, but there is an addiction to finger-wagging disappointment. And I go, let's withdraw our complicity from finger-wagging disappointment. The word disappointment etymologically means I am powerless in the underworld. And I go, you know, it's like an obedient word memo that went out. People would only use that word about Obama. I'm so disappointed in Obama. Try bamboozled or hoodwinked or outraged or some other word, you know, for goodness sake, rather than a bespelling. But I wouldn't, you know, our team, may we throw our, you know, our addiction to finger wagging disappointment into the cauldron, because it stops there, you know, and we go, and let's ladle out, you know, something that, you know, but back to you on outrage as inclusive community thing. Yes.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, I don't see outrage as I see outrage as simply being incomplete. I mean, I think that, you know, there are moments when we should be politically and morally outraged, but we should see that as a beginning rather than an end.
Yes.
And that's the foundation for action. That's not the end of action. And I think that what often happens is that you know, there are a lot of people who are simply powerless because they feel trapped within a neoliberal logic that says that, you know, all responsibility is basically individualized. And they can't imagine what it means collectively to create those formative cultures together in which people can actually, you know, produce social movements that matter. You know, that, you know, in which you can cross borders, real borders, meaning that, you know, you can redefine the very terrain of politics and public life and civic literacy and community and bring those all back into a powerful conglomeration of not just the you know, outrage, but also the recognition that there's a certain joy in being an agent in which you can shape history rather than simply be governed by it. And I think that we see that happening. I mean, I think that one of the great pieces of collective energy that was witnessed in Ferguson and Baltimore was not the fact that people were looting. It was the fact that all of a sudden people had a sense of control over their own sense of agency in ways that, though limited, spoke to a sense of collective power that was very difficult to stop. And I think that the real issue, at least by the dominant, by the established powers, but I think that what's really at work there is the fact that we see certain kinds of outrages now not dissipating in a sense of cynicism, but at least a beginning to recognize that in that those collective struggles, there are real possibilities, a real sense of being able to change things. And now that has to, of course, become part of a long-term rather than simply a short-term strategy, and it has to become international and not just national.
Yeah, well, it's yeah, very much. Wake up and dream. There's a late, great, wonderful Native American activist, Reuben Snake, who quipped, and he said, here's a little bit of Native American wisdom for you. If we don't change our direction, we're likely to end up where we're headed. We go, yes, it's very simple and useful. And we just go, do you like this? Here's where we're going. Do you like this? And if not, let's pull the switch, the story switch, the cultural narrative switch, you know, and conjure and implement, you know, a more desirable story. But also, you do say, you know, neoliberalism, and it is prominent in your book. And I realize, just to confess, what is neoliberalism, Henry?
It's a number of things. I mean, at one level, as an ideology, it kind of construes the notion that profit-making is the essence of democracy, consuming is the only operable form of citizenship, and it has this irrational belief that the market cannot now only solve problems in the economy, but also can govern all of social life. It's a mode of governance. It produces identities, right? It produces subjects. I mean, it produces people who believe that the government should be free of, that business should be free of regulations, that believe in the survivalist ethics, that believe that possessive individualism and self-interest are the basic organizing principles of everyday life. And as a policy, it's wedded to the notion of privatization of public services, selling off of state functions, deregulation of finance and labor, elimination of the welfare state, unions, and as a form of public pedagogy, I mean, literally a form of public pedagogy, it seems to me it legitimates a culture of cruelty and harsh competitiveness and wages a war against public values, public trust, and the public good.
Right. No, I agree. We are in complete accord. I guess I call that the Dementors of Doom sucking the chi out
they
of, you
the
know.
They are the Dementors of Doom.
They are the Dementors of Doom. But if there's a short way, because it's not that important, but why is it called neo-new liberalism? Why is it called?
It's very simple.
Okay.
Because liberalism in the past believed in the social contract.
Yeah.
They believed that labor and capital had to have an accord. They had to be able to work with each other. That in some way that there was a balance that had to be struck, as inequitous as it might be. Neoliberalism doesn't believe in the balance. They don't believe in political concessions, and it's marked by a very specific historical shift. And that is power is now global and politics is local.
Uh-huh.
Being local, it could care less about what happens at the national level. It could care less about workers in Wisconsin. It could care less about Providence, Rhode Island, and the steel mills or the jewelry factories. It just goes to Mexico or it just goes to China. It's ruthless. I mean, it has completely divorced itself from any sense of social cost and divorced itself from any sense of political concessions. It no longer compromises.
So here's you know, in the outrage poker conundrum in which we want to expose and then, you know, kind of reweave the social fabric, but corporate prisons provide prisoners used as firefighters for the world that is now increasingly on fire because of all of these kinds of things. And they cannot afford to let these prisoners out because they don't have the money to fight the fires. And we go, oh, it's all, you know, it is. And, you know, in the privatization of prisons, another great friend of mine, late great friend from Providence, wonderful Jacob Pearl, hello in the ancestor world. But we would drive by Providence and he'd say, looks like a prison, must be a school, you know, which is, you know, and it is hardly indistinguishable, again, the eclipsing of school.
Well, what you're really talking about is you're talking about punishment creep. You know, you're really talking about the way in which the model of the prison has creeped into a whole range of social services, of which the school now is one of the most obvious. I mean, but to move from the language to critique the possibility, the real issue here is turn all jails into schools and libraries.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's true.
I mean, that's where we go with that. I mean, my argument would be, hey, look, we're building more prisons than we are universities, and we have more cops in school now, in some many schools now, than we have teachers. Okay. What do we want to say about that? Let's reverse it. I mean, let's take the cops out of the schools, give them jobs in the community, community services, and let's turn all the prisons into libraries and schools.
And also in one privately owned youth jail, the state pays the private jail $250 a day per prisoner, $90,000 a year for juvenile offenders in quotes. You know, we go, what you could do with that money.
Look, let me give you an example of something that's really bizarre, that operates according to the same logic. The F-35 stealth jet cost $200 to $400 million to build. It doesn't fly in the rain. Its software doesn't work properly, and its cost over 10 years will be $1.5 trillion. Now, you think about what that money can do.
Right. No, we do. And we're going to take a very short break in some 30 seconds or something. But you will be hanging with us. Because we want to look at the freeing of imagination. One of a great late ally, Baltimore, Dennis Livingston, working with people to turn, jails into schools.
Right.
For entrepreneurs, did a lot of great work. But he introduced me to, Institute for Local Self-Reliance that had this crucial thing about cost versus price. Price is what an individual pays. Cost is what the community pays. And once we begin to factor that in, it liberates the imagination into like what we could be doing.
But that's the power of language, right? I mean, because what language does in this case is it refigures common sense in ways that makes it uncommon and makes it subject to an entirely different mode of analysis. I mean, it reinvigorates the imagination by all of a sudden it no longer allowing what is the most ruthless set of social practices to be normalized.
Yes, we're going to take a hold all of your thoughts in your abundant magic backpack. Our wonderful guest today is Henry Giroux. His website is Henry A. Giroux, GIROUX.com. Incredible amount, prolific amount of analytical and creative thinking. I'm Caroline Casey. This is the Visionary Activist Show, and we'll be right back after this very short, pertinent Leonard Cohen break. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our splendid guest today is Henry Giroux. His website is Henry A. Giroux, GIROUX.com. We are honoring his latest of 60 books, The Violence of Organized Forgetting. But my favorite title really is Zombie Politics and Culture in an Age of Casino Capitalism. That's, you hardly even need to read the book. No, you do need to read the book, but the title is fabulous. So, Henry, wonderful. Cost versus price. We were there, over there, somewhere. But in keeping with also Leonard Cohen, we may want to wade into the American election. And I just want to say, yes, third party. I think we're going to agree and to and fro some. Yes, third party, but it does require what Australia has, which is instant runoff voting. Because without that, you have instant voter runoff. You know, in Australia, you get to vote for your first and your second choice, which is much more democratically sensible. And you're calling in the book going, you know, I think you do view the Republicans as maybe more dangerous, but you certainly take to task, you know, for good reason, you know, the Obama curtailing of, you know, death and all of that. And then you say we've got to have a third party now.
Yes, we need a third party. I mean, I think that, I mean, you know, some people will argue, well, it's not going to happen in this election, and they're absolutely right. I mean, it's going to take a while. I mean, people are going to have to build these organizations that are long term and bring candidates in that basically are willing to run, who represent a vision that really matters for democracy. I also think that we need to create the long term institutions that in some way are going to provide the formative cultures that make this happen. But I think it offers a signpost to suggest that there's something outside of an electoral process that's not broken. It's worse than that. It's evil. I mean, it has nothing to do with democracy. It's completely run by the financial elite. And I think to the degree that we begin to recognize that, then we're going to stop talking about democracy only as an electoral process and be far more sensitive to people who basically are saying, hey, look, you know, voting is going to get you nowhere. I mean, of course, there are local elections and you want to put people on school boards that matter. That's okay. But that's a short-term reform. And I think in terms of long-term structural, economic, political, and social change, we're going to have to go completely elsewhere.
And apparently the dog agrees with you.
Yeah, somebody's out my door. I'm sorry.
No, it's quite okay. Is it a Doberman?
No. It's an Akita.
Okay. So, all right.
Japanese dog.
I'm just waving a fond to the ancestor Doberman going,
you remember, don't you?
I do. I hope it turned out okay, but don't tell me. But anyway, yes, the Akita. No, good. Well, who let the dog out? We want to vote for everybody, including the dogs, because, you know, a wonderfully astute listener pointed out, she said she was getting all, you know, appropriately grumpy about the 1%, 99%, but realizing that, you know, maybe a metaphor with an expiration date going, you know, useful, and then we move on. Because she said, you know, in fact, you know, as a species on this planet, we're the 1%. I mean, we're the 1% species that's using everything, you know, and the dog agrees, you know, and going, yeah, we're using everything. So we are voting and dedicating, you know, voting means desire. We are voting and dedicating on behalf of many, many other beings. Again, collective welfare, not just human, of course, you know, and there is an urgency and a crisis. I think the dog soundtrack is fine. We work with everything, Henry.
I think you're right. I feel you are right. I mean, my sense of, you know, look, you know, as soon as nature becomes an object, as soon as animals become nothing more than pets, or for food consumption, something begins to happen around questions of objectification and reification, and something begins to happen in this hierarchy. It seems to me it was human beings believe that reason only includes them as a species. I mean, you know, Adorno wrote about this. Marcuse wrote about this. We know where it goes. And I think now what we're facing is a planet that's on the verge of destruction environmentally, ecologically, precisely because of that notion of objectification. I mean, you know, Hannah Arendt had a great line. She says, humanity doesn't exist alone. You know, and she's right. And it doesn't exist alone, both in terms of the species itself, in that we are not just individuals alone on the island. This is not reality TV. And the other side of this is that we have to begin to reinvigorate this sense of human and social connectedness.
Right.
I mean, we don't know what it means anymore, because you have a system that has so individualized the social that it's impossible to think about dependency in social relationships in terms of compassion, trust, and justice. They have been just thrown out the window. I mean, that's why we, you know, when we talk about people...
Wait, we're underneath the window catching them, though. Okay, all right.
Back. No, we are, no, there are people catching them. And when I say they have thrown it out the window, you know, because they control the cultural apparatuses that depoliticize people, because they normalize that crap. And it seems to me to the degree to which we stop normalizing it and begin to think about what it does mean to exist on this planet in a way that matters with others and ourselves, something happens. A light bulb goes on. You know, the possibility of agency becomes energizing and invigorating. I mean, it moves people. I mean, the thought that we can make a difference in a world in which we're often told we can't is a great transformation. For me, it's flipping the script. You know, I mean, you know, as a working class kid, I had to flip the script because I was defined by my deficits, not my strengths. And then when I realized that their strengths were actually their deficits, something began to happen. And I think it's when we flip that script and all of a sudden the radical imagination becomes central to that flipping, I think a lot of things begin to happen that offer all kinds of new possibilities.
No, that's great, and I'm so delighted that you have kept alive and vibrant your beautiful Providence working class accent, which is really great.
And you know, everybody thinks I'm from New York.
No, oh really? Oh, well, we know that this is uniquely Providence and very wonderful. And again, we love all of that. And you did a great thing with Bill Moyers also when you know we're just describing your neighborhood growing up. You know, that it was a working class of intellectual vibrancy. Yeah?
That's right. No, exactly. I mean, you bet. I mean, my neighborhood was not, I mean, first of all, let me not romanticize that neighborhood.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of sexism, there's a lot of racism, obviously, right? Because we believed what they told us, to put it bluntly. And it seemed to me when you begin to unlearn that stuff, all of a sudden you begin to recognize, I began to recognize the strengths in that neighborhood, the stories that the elderly men and women would tell about labor struggles, about the neighborhood. You know, when somebody was sick, people came out of their apartments. Nobody owned a house. People would come out of their apartments. They would feed you for months.
Right.
I mean, and, you know, all of us, and the thing that always, especially now, particularly impresses me, because I've sort of lost it in this Canadian Anglican world in which I now live, is that nobody existed alone. You couldn't survive alone. You had to relate to other people. You had to, the social was paramount, not this sense of narrow individualized agency that now corrupts everything. That was a great sense. That was a great awakening for me, and also a part of a sensibility I've never lost.
Yes, and again to kind of toss the Ayn Rand influence into the cauldron. A friend of mine, again decades back in Providence, said, you know, one of the great snookerings of the American public was in a sociological questionnaires. They would say that people feel increasingly themselves. And as individuals, to the degree to which they are out of relationship, and it's like, oh, there's the snookering that, yeah, and let's throw American exceptionalism into the cauldron as part of that too, going because it's really like second grade infantile, like we're better, you know. I mean, it's completely immature and irrelevant. So into the cauldron.
No, it's a great word. I love that word.
Which
I mean,
one?
Because it is a form of infantilism.
It is.
I mean, and I think that if you really want to understand how depoliticization works in the United States and in some cases other places, all you have to do is to ask yourself, what are the forces at work that are consistently reproducing that, whether we're talking about the Kardashian sisters and celebrity culture, or we're talking about schools that are now claiming that they can't read Howard, students can't read Howard Zinn.
Really?
Or, you know, they have to take standardized tests all day. They're banning certain kinds of books. I mean, this incredible attack on the imagination is so intense that it gives you hope. Because it makes you realize how dangerous it is.
Right, there you go. I love that. And part of the dynamic, or one maybe, you know, I go the violence of poverty is, you know, the circumstances, yes, but the greater violence is the constraint and destruction.
That's completely right. I mean, because the argument that's often made beyond the fact that people who are poor want to be poor, so that there's not a war on poverty, there's a war on the poor. I mean, is that somehow they have choices without constraints. And the fact of the matter is, if you really want to mock the map of inequality, what you have to recognize is that choices without constraints is a matter of power and wealth, increasingly, and not a power, not about the essence of character. That's a great revelation.
Okay. Let's see. Where shall we go now? Shall we go back to the election? Oh, I just want to bring up, you know, the power of of language and you know, going backwards to go forwards. And that includes etymology. So our word inaugurate comes from the augur, meaning really the diviner, the pattern tracker in all of us who would walk out into nature and read nature's patterns and by that pattern determine who the most responsible human steward was on a local or larger level, and then they would be inaugurated. So there's a kind of magic to it once way under the thing, and we go, well, let's bring that back. You know, who can we trust to work with, you know, collectively, you know, who is the best, you know, sane, reverent, common sense sort of, you know, steward person, then we inaugurate, but not you know, to abdicate.
What this suggests to me is that, you know, to talk about a kind of innovative, imaginative understanding of the world, to talk about civic literacy and all of its blossoming in a way which it can contribute to a dialogue within ourselves and between ourselves and others, I mean, speaks to a couple of things. It means we have to be in relationships where we can be vulnerable. We can be vulnerable, you know, that we're not operating out of a script that's predetermined, in which rather than engaging in the magic of language, you know, we engage in its death and its death knell. And I think there's something so that is the war against the uncertain, the war that now mirrors a kind of thoughtlessness because it refuses to engage the possibility of not having the answer all the time, or the joy of what it means to explore something for which there may not be one answer.
Right.
You know, that to me is one of the great tasks of what it means to rebuild the radical imagination anywhere. You know, to all of a sudden not to be able to narrate yourself in a way that suggests that, you know, what we're saying is incomplete. You know, it can't be reduced to some kind of instrumental rationality, that the private should never be frozen.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? What it means is that our sense of having feelings and sort of merging the body and the mind in ways that allow us to take chances, to sort of,
right,
you know, to move beyond the given,
and to
engage the social in a way that it liberates the private, as opposed to simply claiming that's all there is.
Right. And, you know, a kin certainly of imagination is wonder. And
yes, absolutely.
Wonder is a very not very popular in the modern world, you know, until now, because we're supposed to have a snappy, you know, branded sense of identity and retirement funds and all that. But in ancient world, see, wonder was considered a fantastic accomplishment because it means you don't have certainty. You know, I wonder, and that was thought of as,
yeah,
you know, the backstage metaphoric gods would go, look, that person has run out of certainty. Now the divine can inspire them. So, you know, a kind of more ancient form going wonder, and it is great in frisky conversations that we want to catalyze everywhere. It is a wonderful liberation to change one's mind in discourse. I love being critiqued and changing mind, and I love the to and fro when I give a fierce critique back and somebody goes, thank you, and I go, that is like the best dance ever, you know, to be able to, you know, have that wondering and fluidity and to, you know, put ideas out there and to share and to go, no, I don't agree with that. And that climate of, you know, smart wonder and willingness to have the exhilarating energy of changing mind is very fun too.
I mean, for me, a question centrally related to that insight is that we need to create the public spheres that make that possible.
Okay.
You know? And I think that I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. I mean, a very simple example. You know, you have a whole generation of young people in the United States who are now basically in debt. And, you know, we could say that that's merely a financial problem engineered by the financial elite to sort of once again, you know, extract as much surplus from young people as possible, surplus wealth. But actually, it's more than that. It's actually a war on the imagination, because what we're condemning a whole generation of young people to is to a survivalist ethic in which all they can think about is basically making enough money to pay off their loans. And it seems to me that when we begin to realize how central that notion of the radical imagination is, that give and take, that sense of uncertainty, that being able to be in a sphere that makes that possible, that to me reinvigorates the struggle for what I would call a democratic imaginary.
Yes. Yeah, and again, yes, as schools and places of learning, many, you know, as you mentioned, and we all know, you know, the being outsourced, all the arts departments being outsourced to accountants and all of that everywhere. Goldman Sachs has been buying up art schools. It's like, oh God.
But to take off on your argument, I mean, the other side of this is that, you know, look, there are all kinds of alternative spheres, public spheres that have now opened up that are just unimaginable. I mean, Truth Hour, you know, Counterpunch, your program, public radio. I mean, these outlets 10 years ago, I couldn't get published. You know, 10 years ago, I wasn't being interviewed. And all of a sudden, now I write a piece of Truth out and 50,000 people read it in a week.
Right.
I mean, so
there
really is these spaces demand that we not become simply cultural critics, but also cultural producers.
Right.
And it seems to me that that's a pedagogical task that would be central, I would think, to any kind of radical imaginative politics.
Okay, define pedagogical.
Pedagogical in the sense that it's not simply about teaching, it's about a moral and political practice that relates power to knowledge and the possibility of what it means to become an individual and social agent, somebody who learns how to govern and not simply be governed.
That's great. So it is efficient to use that word.
I love that word.
Okay.
I think that word far exceeds the notion of teaching, right?
Right. Okay. All right. We'll animate it and rescue it from academic left wing stuff. Going pedagogical. That's really great. Yeah. Truth Out, Counterpunch. Yeah. This show, Pacifica Radio. I mean, all that. But
your show is a prime example of public pedagogy.
Oh, good. Can I use that as a blurb? Right.
No, it's perfect. I mean, first of all, you know, you've got this brilliant woman, you know, talking about a whole range of issues that connect people to a world in which you're arguing it's possible to have it transformed. And that there's a joy in that. There's a certain amount of joy that it's not just a task. It's not a reductive political imposition. It's a way to open up the political in ways that really nourish the possibility for social justice and collective agency. Man, that's pedagogical to me.
Cool. I've never been called that. I love it. Okay. I now love it. I've changed my mind. But also this theme. So as you know, we're all wet fingers in the wind going, there is a shift. You're published. This show's good. You know, years and years ago did, you know, first book on recording for Sounds True. And I was calling it visionary activism and they go, no, activism doesn't sell. And I go, really? It's Hinayana Honky personal salvation. And they were like, pretty much, but that's not true now. You know, I mean, in a way, it's almost too. I mean, the word activism needs to be refreshed too. It's almost gone too much the other way. But to focus also on what we're engaged in perpetuity is, you know, a climate shift, a metaphoric climate shift, and atmosphere. Let us be public dreamers and artists of atmosphere to create the atmosphere where the desirable can happen. To address the literal climate. And
right.
But now we come back to, you know, my willingness to vote in the upcoming election. I don't know where you are, but just let me put it this way too, which is if the scariness of, say, Hillary Clinton, which is like conniption fit inducing, going, no, but if her flaw is expediency, then isn't our task to make that our ally? Let's make it expedient, you know, for the befoibled to do the good.
The only way expediency works is in the shorthand language for short-term reforms. I mean, I to me, you know, that may be expedient, but if it reproduces in the long run the notion that the only politics we know, you know, and can come to know is the politics of the Democratic and Republican parties, I think we're done.
Well, we're not done. Let's put on the table that we're completely in accord, third party. What a good idea. But I would insist on instant runoff voting like Australia as a way of not abdicating
I
mean, there's too much of life at stake, inch.
No, people suffer because of immediate policies. And I've never bought the left argument was which was one left argument, which was that as the contradictions get greater, you know, there'll be some kind of political guarantees. Well, there are no political guarantees.
No, that's a kind of Trotsky thing. Yeah, all right. Cool. Nobody that's heard cool. that. And also remember, you know, I'm planning our July 4th, July 2nd show with possibly NSA whistleblowers and really interesting people and writers on the NSA. But remember, they in order to be whistleblowers like Edward Snowden, they were in the thing. They were like rah rah. Oh wait
no,
a minute.
Don't get me wrong. The politics that I'm arguing for is not one of marginal exclusion. My argument is one foot in and one foot out. My argument is I'm not willing to turn any institution over to the right or to some other fascist group. I don't believe that. I think all institutions should be sites of struggle. But that doesn't mean that we have to define democracy exclusively by elections.
Right, yes.
So for me, you know, there's an old saying from the left about the long march through the institutions. I believe in that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not giving up on the institutions. That's reconfiguring the largest set of structural, economic, political, and social forces that, in fact, they will be located. I.e., for instance, huge corporations should be disbanded. They should be broken
yes.
up.
Yes, right. And also,
that's not going to happen in the Democratic and Republican parties.
Right.
You should have national health care. That's not going to happen in the Democratic and Republican parties.
I am very grateful to Obamacare. We know it's not perfect. We know it's not perfect, but I know people whose lives have been saved. So we go, that's an inch. It's an inch.
No, it's true, but it's also an act of cowardice on the part of a Democratic Party that actually should have allowed a public option. And
yes.
they sold out to the insurance and the drug companies.
They did, but I'm
and
still...
I think so. We need some balance here. I mean, I'm willing to say, yes, that's a step forward, but at the same time, I'm willing to recognize that a certain kind of ethical tranquilization took place in producing that policy that operates very, very normally within these established parties. They're out to serve the financial elite, and sometimes one party makes a few more concessions than the others. But believe me, I mean, outside of those minor concessions, you have 45 million people who don't have health care.
Right. Well, and also, there's the quip that the problem with the Democratic Party is they sell themselves so cheap. But I love your one foot in, one foot out. That is Henry's hokey poke. That's the hokey poke. You put your foot in anyway. But so we're doing that. And then as the war on imagination, I want to bring in just one other brief, thing from the past. The episode of Star Trek where the evil spirit that the Dementors of Doom that feeds on fear takes over the ship. And basically what Captain Kirk does is he encourages everybody to get high. And so as the evil spirit is going, you're all going to die and you have to give up your liberty. You know, it's kind of what's going on now. And they go.
Cheney.
Well, and the crew members all laugh, going, boy, this guy sure is gloomy. And they suck all the chi out of the chi sucker, right? I go, all right, popular culture, useful there. Because we do want to maintain, hey, this guy sure is gloomy, and a critique, which also is a kind of, earned irony that we find in other places in the world. I want to do a particular shout out to so many friends in Palmyra, Syria, where I spent some time, and the incredibly savvy Bedouins outside and the creative eccentrics, and Daesh does not have a lot of tolerance for them. But in talking politics, which is an unusual thing to be a Western woman in the Middle East, is an all-access pass in Syria as it was, because we could be with the men from outside the family and talk politics, and we could be with the women when the men were. But in Palmyra, the Bedouins were very savvy about American politics, more informed about American politics than many Americans, and they did have a sense of irony. And they had this conversation. They were like, yes, a third party is really necessary, but in the meantime, here's what you got. I mean, so I just want to bring in irony as well. And we're in our last minute, Henry. So if you wanted to exhort or have a blessing, a well-wishing, if anything were possible, or however you want to use this.
No, I mean, for me, I think we're living at a time when everything is possible.
Yay.
And I think we need to recognize that while it's possible, it's not going to happen if we find ourselves trapped in individual kinds of silos. I mean, I think that we need to be able to think otherwise in order to act otherwise, that we need to do it with other people, we need to work collectively, and we need to recognize that there's an enormous amount of joy in that.
Yes.
I mean, I love what I do. I love what I do because I hate human suffering. And it seems to me that to be able to do that with others gives me hope in the species. It means that there's something there that we can recapture, reinvigorate, you know, make come alive again, that all of a sudden makes the world look like a place that's worth saving.
Yes, indeed. Time for all allies to reconvene. A great pleasure to conversationally cahoot with you, Henry Giroux.
Thank you so much, Caroline.
A great pleasure. And I'm born on Hannah Arendt's birthday. I don't know if that heartens me. Henry Giroux, A. Giroux, his website, Henry A. Giroux, GIROUX.com. Incredible amount of reading whereby to feed your intellect and engage in discourse. May we all do that. Thanks always to Alex Drewinskis in Washington, D.C., Erica Bridgman in Berkeley, and the team, Coyote Network News. News.com, and you can find Henry's wonderful interview with Bill Moyers on Facebook page Coyote Network News. Thanks again, Henry. Off he goes. Woof woof.
Are you tired of The Matrix?
The movie?
No, not the movie, but the one you're living in. If so, then hang out with your friends at The Full Circle.
What's The Full Circle?
Full Circle is a radio show written, produced, and directed by apprentices right here at KPFA. We'll bring you everything from the obscure to the obvious, the hidden and the blatant, as well as all things in between. So be informed. Hear about your world community every Friday night from 7 to 8 p.m. on 94.1 FM, where we'll serve you the red pill with love.
Hello, I'm Veronica Faison.
I got my mojo working, baby, and I'm gonna try it on you.
I'm inviting you to join me on my new talk show, The Week Starts Here, Sunday night, 7:30 to 9 p.m. on KPFA. Together, you and I will tear down barriers, make new friends, and build bridges into the future one week at a time. Sunday nights will never be the same. The Week Starts Here, 7:30 to 9 p.m. right here on 94.1 KPFA.
My mojo working. Oh, yeah. I'm a rugalator working.
And you are listening to 94.1.